Before we start this episode of Conversations with Kenyatta, I'm excited to tell you about my new partnership with Audible. Listeners can go to www.audibletrial.com/Kenyatta to receive a free 30-day trial. Audible is a wonderful resource with audiobooks for every reader. It even has titles from authors that have been on my podcast, such as Dr. Dan Bouck's Democracy's Data and Gail Lukasik's White Like Her. And please note that this is an affiliate link, so I may receive a commission with no cost to you, just a free trial with so many wonderful titles. And I love to read. But with that, here's this week's episode of Conversations with Kenyatta. Welcome to episode 15 of Conversations with Kenyatta. Today, I'm joined by LaBrenda Garrett Nelson, an author, professional genealogist, and currently president of BCG. Welcome, LaBrenda. But let's get started with sort of what prompted your interest in genealogy.
Well, you know, I thought about that question, and I think I was primed to develop an interest in genealogy by my paternal grandmother. I lived with her with my paternal grandparents until I was ready to start like school. That's when my parents brought me to New York. And my paternal grandmother talked a lot about her family, but she talked even more about my grandfather's family, the Garretts. And it's not that there were any famous people or anything, but she was really proud of them. And so I had that in kind of the back of my mind always. She made sure of that with all of her grandchildren. But really, the simple answer is, like a lot of other Americans, when Roots was published, I read it, and that's when I really got the bug, that I understood that, hey, I can document this stuff and write it down for other people to, if they care to, learn about. That's what really got me started. I remember going down to, I was living in New York, so visiting the National Archives, and all I looked at there, all I knew to look at, were the census records. But this was in the late 70s, but that was thrilling enough for me to see the names of just my great-grandparents on a census record. So I've kind of had the bug since then.
That's awesome. So prior to becoming a professional genealogist, you've had this very illustrious career. Tell us a little bit about your career, you know, before you decided to make genealogy your full-time job.
I always try to be very honest about why I went to law school. I used to tell people that if I weren't so squeamish, I would have tried to go to medical school, because what I wanted to live a comfortable life. I admit that to people. And so I was, and then by happenstance, I just seemed to find myself in the right places at the right time. For example, I went to NYU School of Law, and I didn't have a clue when I got in that that's like on everybody's list of top 10 law schools. I literally could have as well ended up at Brooklyn Law School, which is a fine school, especially because at the time I was thinking I would still be in New York. And Brooklyn Law School is a fine school for people who practice like locally. It all turned on like how much money were people offering me. That is why I ended up at NYU, which was a great place for me to be. And that getting into that law school led me to my first job out of law school was at a major New York law firm. And and I think this is how life is. So you start at a major firm and then everybody just assumes you're smart or something. That's how I think life happens. Because I went from there to, I went into the tax department of this firm because all of the other departments seemed as if the people were crazed. Like the people who litigated were like never went home. The corporate securities guys, the same thing. We worked hard and I worked long hours. However, the tax people were in on the beginning of transactions and it seemed more leisurely the pace at which they worked. And so that was, you know, so that was another thing I fell into, but I turned out to be kind of good at it. And I started practicing tax law at a time when people thought young tax lawyers should have some sort of government experience. And so a lot of people who, very prominent tax lawyers were, had been at Treasury or at one of the tax writing committees on Capitol Hill. And again, you know, things kind of happened that someone who was like a premier tax lawyer, his wife got an appointment to the 11th Circuit. And so he joined the firm I was with. And because he needed to move to Washington and his firm didn't have a tax practice in Washington. And he ended up giving me a recommendation to work on the staff of the Joint Tax Committee, which is which traditionally was a nonpartisan staff that worked on both the House and the Senate sides. It's a technical staff. It's not a staff where a lot of politicking goes on. That's how it was in my day anyway. I don't know what's happening on Capitol Hill today, but that was actually the best job I had ever had because I felt as if I was actually doing something to contribute to the public good. I worked on the Tax Reform Act of 1986, where we took a lot of poor people off the rolls. And, you know, the tax code is used in many ways to implement social aims. And we did a little bit of that. And I say we because there are members of Congress who are very smart and who can be briefed on this stuff and are able to formulate their own opinions. But the tax law is so arcane that these staffs really do have a lot to do with how things get shaped. Now, when constituents come complaining to members, they might figure out that things weren't done exactly as they thought they were going to be done. But it's really the kind of thing that you can, and the Hill is, Capitol Hill is that way. It's a place where you can almost assume as much responsibility as you're willing to take on. And I think that's one of the reasons I enjoyed that job so much. And from there, I left the Hill and went to a big Maryland, like the largest law firm in Maryland, but in their DC office. And I tried my hand on a number of other things. But the fact of the matter was, is that people who knew about me, knew me from having worked in government and on the Hill. And so for the last probably 10 or 15 years that I've practiced, this is, I'm talking about a 35-year period. I worked as a tax lawyer for 35 years. I was focused on the things people come to Washington, D.C. for, which is lobbying or at Treasury or the Hill. And it's technical lobbying. You can't really get stuff done in the tax area without working with someone who knows what the tax law says. But it still amounted to, so I testified on behalf of clients on the Hill. I testified at IRS, did white papers for people I did. But it was basically, it was more technical work than the lobbying, although I worked in my shop with people who were focused on the lobbying aspects of it. And that was kind of fun. But all of that, all the while, I'll have to say, my family, because I produced three different family history books before I ever took a course and really didn't quite know what I was doing. And my family would say, how do you have time to do this? Because I had a very busy practice, but I was enjoying what I was doing, and it wasn't until a couple of years before I knew I was going to retire, because fortunately for us, I had with some guys I had worked with on the Hill started our own law firm, and Ernst & Young, which is now one of the big four accounting firms, basically acquired us, took in our practice, but they left us alone. They let us stay in our like law firm like offices as opposed to the kinds of offices they had. We continued doing the same thing, and all of the big four accounting firms have a mandatory retirement age of 60. And some people go on to teach somewhere else, or, you know, we all are subject to, because I was a partner there, non-compete clauses. But still, so people continue working in that area. I was quite content to take my pension from Ernst & Young to focus full time on what had always been a vocation for me, and that was genealogy.
I mean, that's great. I think having a law degree really helps you with the discipline, the focus, the research, the writing, and all of that with genealogy. I mean, it's
Oh, that's absolutely true. And even before I ever took a course, I had an inkling that I should try to cite sources for things in my family history book, but I didn't. Not only did I not do a perfect job of that, and I tell people this when I speak to folks, that yes, I have a law degree and I have a graduate law degree from NYU, but that didn't prepare me to practice good genealogy. And I made all of the mistakes that newbies make that you shouldn't make, like the names the same. I made that mistake. The worst thing I did was my great-grandfather, Garrett great-grandfather, had a sister named Early, and she married a man named Crockett Beasley. And I found an Earlene and a Crockett Beasley in my county, paid no attention to their birth dates and how they were a whole generation away from my great-grandfather. And that was in one of my first editions of our family history book. And it wasn't until I went to the Beasley burial ground that I said, wait a minute, this is my great-grandfather's sister, and that other person was much too old to be my... So basic mistakes with all of my training. And I made without, because I didn't have it in my head that genealogy is a discipline and there's stuff to learn to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And I'm glad you bring that up. So with this being a discipline and, you know, you chose this as to be a professional genealogist, and, you know, it seems after you retired that this is what you decided to do. But why this? Why genealogy as opposed to teaching or as opposed to doing some other things you could have, I don't know, gardening or whatever else, right?
I feel as if I'm really on a mission. That I have that statement on my website, but I really do believe that as good as you are, as good as I think I am, I believe that African Americans, the community as a whole, is underserved mm-hmm. in this area. That there are not enough people who are serious about learning this, treating this as a discipline, and practicing good genealogy. And I say that I went to a conference once where there was a session at the Library of Virginia, and one of the librarians there asked for a show of hands to indicate how many people were experienced genealogists in the room, and nearly everyone raised their hands. But I could tell about 5 minutes into her talk by the questions that were being asked that these folks, they like me have been, before I ever took a course, have been doing it for decades, but not approaching it mm-hmm. in a disciplined way. And so part of what the reason that I focus on writing and lecturing is to share what I've learned about how to do this work and to do it in a way that produces credible family histories for African-American families, particularly those. I always have to qualify it these days, because there are lots of African-American families that did not come out of slavery, and that's my focus.
And I appreciate your statement about the discipline part of genealogy, but also a lot of folks not taking it kind of seriously in a way, and then being underserved within the community, because all of those things are true. People sometimes see these announcements about records coming out or records access for the Freedmen's Bureau or for this, you know, this collection, and feel like, oh, well, we have all the stuff, or it's online or whatever. But if you don't know what to do with it as the average person, you don't know how to interpret the record, and you don't have anywhere to go
exactly
to understand how to interpret that record.
And it has nothing to do with your intelligence or your level of education. Mm-hmm. I'm an example of that. It has to do with your being trained mm-hmm. as a genealogist.
Absolutely.
I had, I'm not going to say the name of this historian, but I have a situation where an historian who's been published by a major university press basically claimed some of my ancestors. And I, at the time it happened, I and another a cousin and I just bombarded this person with emails. And when the person finally responded, the response was, oh, I relied on my cousin. And so here's this person who's an historian and actually teaching at an Ivy League college or university and published by a major university press, and just took what her, I don't want to say her, but took what the cousin gave the person. And so if someone reads the article that I published in the Q last year very closely, they'll see a footnote where I note that there is a conflicting but undocumented origin story for one of my ancestors in a particular book cited in that.
Okay, well, we don't have to look at that to get the tea on that story.
Because here's a historian who doesn't like clearly doesn't respect genealogy as a discipline, and that requires learning and more than having your cousin give you something and you throw it in your book.
Exactly. When that cousin may not have cited the sources or just got it from a tree on Ancestry, but I digress. So getting to discipline. So you're the president of the Board for Certification of Genealogists, or BCG. So what is BCG?
Well, BCG was organized in 1964 by some folk who were viewed as leaders in the genealogical community. Members of the American Society of Genealogists, which is the honorary society in this field. There are never more than 50 living members, leaders of the National Genealogical Society. They got together and decided that there was a need for an organization to provide a credential for people to promote standards and ethics, genealogy standards and ethics, because BCG was the first organization to develop a code of ethics for genealogists. Now, NGS has one, Association of Professional Genealogists has one, but back in 64, there was a vacuum. And in that vacuum were a lot of people who thought they were genealogists and coming up with results that really weren't credible results. I think that things have, when I started really calling myself doing this back in the 70s, even the standards weren't as developed as they are today. I think the profession has come such a long way mm-hmm. in terms of becoming more professional and becoming a discipline that's more worthy of respect, even though it's not still not getting all the respect it should get. So they formed the Board for Certification of Genealogists. Over the years, the BCG has granted different kinds of credentials. Today, there are only two. You can be a certified genealogist and you can be a certified genealogical lecturer once you have the certified genealogist credential. Originally, you could be a certified genealogical research specialist, and some people only had that credential. But that doesn't really prepare you to do all that a professional genealogist should have to do. And let me say that even though I'm president of BCG, I always point out, because I know folk like you who just haven't taken the time to submit a portfolio and to go through this, it doesn't mean they're not doing excellent work. And I say that. To folks. I don't want people to think that you must become a certified genealogist, but I do emphasize the need to engage in continuing education and to learn about standards and continue. It's a never-ending process, especially, for example, now so many people are still just starting to learn about using DNA as a tool, for example. Mm-hmm. And so, and those standards are fairly new. So BCG publishes the book titled Genealogy Standards, and what it is a compilation of best practices in the field. And it's not just for certified genealogists. It's for anyone who's interested in practicing good genealogy.
Mm-hmm. And the certification process, I mean, just kind of describe that for the listeners. But I will say one of the main reasons why I am not certified is because when I was doing genealogy, I was working full time or started doing genealogy professionally. I was working full time. I mean, I worked full time doing genealogy roadshow, right? That was my side gig. So the process to me seems to be a bit overwhelming, I will admit.
Well, yeah, and you know, and that's, and we have really tried over the years and even up until now to simplify the process. When I applied, I had the luxury of retiring from my first life and taking about 6 months to do nothing, which is for me was not a fun time. I can't not be doing something. And then like, and really embarking on this goal of becoming a certified genealogist, something I didn't know existed like a couple of years before that. And so I had I took a year to actually just focus on doing that and nothing else. And at that time, for example, There are a number of projects you have to complete, and one is called a kinship determination project, where you have to satisfy the genealogical proof standard in connecting parent-child links in up to, at the time for me, it was 4 generations. Well, now today that's only 3 generations that you have to do. And when I applied, and I applied back in 2015, the document work consisted of 2 different documents. When you apply, when you submit a preliminary application, you're asked what you're familiar, what record groups, what area do you work in? And the reason you ask that question is because a document is chosen for you in your area of interest. And so I didn't get a document from my home county in South Carolina, but from somewhere else in South Carolina, I got several documents. And with those documents, you're supposed to, one, analyze the document in terms of what information is in this document. You're supposed to frame your own research question based on an individual named in the document, and then do a very preliminary research plan. And the point of that is to see how you would approach something brand new to you. How do you go about handling a document when you... So when I applied, they sent you a document, and then you got to choose a document of your own, and people would tell you, try to choose something different from what they sent you. So that was like the only part of the portfolio you couldn't really do ahead of time, choosing your own document, because you wouldn't know until then what document they were sending. So they, for example, sent me some papers from estate files. And so I chose a deed reflecting a purchase of real estate as my document. Well, today we figured out we don't really need you to go through the same exercise twice. So you don't have to choose a document. You will just get a document and go through that procedure with respect to the document that you're sent. And so those are just a couple of examples of the ways in which we're kind of figuring out that we really didn't have to make folk jump through all of the hoops that I jumped through when I first applied. And even on the renewals, because you know you have to, well, I'm jumping ahead. The basic process though is that you file a preliminary application and you pay $75 to do that. And there are people who file the preliminary application and they continue extending it year after year, because once you file it, technically you have a year from that time to submit your final portfolio. I didn't understand that there are people who've been on the clock, as they say, once you file the preliminary application, for years. And sometimes they never file the actual portfolio, but they do that because you get access to two things that can be very helpful. And one is the BCG newsletter, which is published 3 times a year. And there is usually a skill building article in the newsletter. And then you find out other things going on at BCG. And the other thing is that there's something called an action list. And I don't ask, it's an acronym for something. But the fact is that you can ask questions while you're on the clock. And really well-known genealogists will provide answers. You can't ask questions about your portfolio as such. We can't give advice about specifics of your portfolio, but you can get answers to lots of questions. So that's one reason I think people stay on the clock. It's a way to kind of get to know other people in the community, because you'll see questions being posted by other people on the clock, and others on the clock may weigh in. So that's the first step, just filing that preliminary application. I foolishly thought you really only had to do it. You had to do it in a year, and it would somehow be cheating if you didn't. So I just really worked really hard to, the only thing I did in advance was to find someone to do a research report for, because the other thing you have to do, the document work, the kinship determination, and you have to write a research report, paid or unpaid, for someone else. You have to have their permission to submit it to BCG. And it cannot be, that's the only piece of the portfolio that cannot involve your own family. Can't be you, can't be your spouse's family, because again, the aim is to see how you handle an area that you're not familiar with. What skills do you have? The most difficult part of the portfolio, I think, is the case study, because you have to find an issue to write about, and you can use your own family for this. And you can use your own family for the kinship determination. In fact, that's part of one of the pieces of advice I got. Do your own family for the kinship determination, because otherwise, you know your family. That's the easy part, right? The case study, though, you have to identify an issue that there is no direct, uncontroverted evidence for. And you have to resolve it using either a combination of direct or indirect or negative evidence. And it has to be a substantive question. It can't be like, what was the birth date of someone? Like, it has to be something that with meat in it. You could have two pieces of direct evidence that are conflicting, or direct evidence that conflicts with a bunch of indirect evidence. And you have to kind of use your inferential reasoning. And it's a question that where there shouldn't be any low-hanging fruit. Because if you do find clear evidence, direct evidence, you have to find another question. So that's the most difficult part of a lot of the articles that you see published in the National Genealogical Society Quarterly are submissions that folks made as part of their portfolios. That was certainly the first article I published, was my case study. And it's meant to be. It's not meant to be easy. It's meant to be, what do you do? And this is especially important when you're researching African-American ancestors that came out of slavery, because you're not going to find a lot of direct evidence. You really will have to go after the indirect evidence and use your reasoning to figure out a credible solution. So those are the four substantive projects: the kinship determination, the document work, the research report for a third party, and the case study. And again, you can do it in less than a year, and you can submit. Some people are practicing, and so they get permission to submit stuff that they're getting paid for. And it doesn't have to be something that you did just for the portfolio, if you have the permission of the person you did it for to submit it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you kind of documented that process, because I didn't know it. I kind of knew there was a lot of stuff going on there. There's a lot of work.
Yeah, And the thing is that to keep in mind is that we have one paid person, our executive director, and everything else is done on a voluntary basis, including the people who evaluate the portfolios. And it is, I've heard people raise questions about that process, but we have people, experienced genealogists, for a new portfolio, three different people independently review your portfolio. That's why it sometimes takes a long time, because people are volunteering their time to do this. We have, the process is a little, moves a little more quickly now, because in the old days, people actually had to get the portfolio, review it, and then mail it to the next person.
Oh, wow.
And now, I think last year we publicly reported, we had one paper portfolio. So now you no longer have to necessarily wait for three people to do that. The first judge is chosen based on that person's expertise and time and availability by the executive director. And then the first judge, we call them judges, chooses the second one, and the second one chooses the third one. So you have three people working independently, and they're not supposed to talk.
Right.
And they come up with their recommendation for approval. And it's pass fail. That's the other thing. Mm. There are a few perfect portfolios that are submitted. And you can obtain the credential even if you have problems. For example, I think I heard someone say that no one ever really fails because they haven't gotten the hang of citations, because that's the kind of thing that's called easily remediable. If there are things that with more study, once they're pointed out, the person can improve, that doesn't prevent you from being, because as I said, I think I've heard one case where someone got like all meets standards, as opposed to partially meet standards or doesn't meet standard on a particular issue. And sometimes, so if all three judges say that you're approved, you're approved. If there's any difference of opinion, two judges could say you're not and one could say you are. Mm-hmm. A fourth, more senior person makes the final call. Interesting. So there are people who have that situation where one judge, only one judge of the three said that they should get it, and the more senior evaluator agreed with them. To some extent, it's somewhat subjective, but I don't know if anybody's thought of a better system, mm-hmm. because it's looking at the substance of what people submit. Again, it's all volunteers. So
yeah, no, I understand. I mean, you know, having being president of APG, I get it. It's all volunteer work that makes these organizations kind of, you know, function. And I really appreciate you kind of peeling back the curtain of BCG and what exactly goes into that process. And not just from the applicant's perspective, but from the judges and from everything else to get to the final certification. And feedback is important. Hopefully those who do get feedback take it to heart and actually do something with it. But I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about another organization you're involved in, which is the Sons and Daughters of the United States Middle Passage. And it's a lineage society for individuals or descendants of individuals enslaved in English colonial America and United States of America from 1619 to 1865. So what is a lineage society and who is eligible for membership in the Sons and Daughters?
Well, I'll tell you that I guess the best known lineage societies are the Daughters of the American Revolution. And although they have lots of African-American members now, they have a rather murky history when it comes to Black folks. I'm trying to remember where I read this. There's a modern history of genealogy that talks about advent of these lineage societies after the Civil War being part and parcel of kind of the rise of white supremacy, that lineage societies were used as a way to exclude people. The one that I'm involved with, which is a way to honor those ancestors. And it's interesting because the woman whose idea it was is an African-American member of DAR. She had the idea of doing this. This idea was in her head before she knew that she was eligible to join DAR. And she went to their headquarters just to learn more about this. Now, I understand that some time ago, there was an effort to do this, another effort to do this, to start a lineage society to honor ancestors who were here before slavery ended. But it turned into more of a membership association rather than a true lineage mm-hmm. society. Because the president of Sons and Daughters and many of the early members were DAR members, our qualifications, our requirements are very similar. Proving your direct descent from someone who fits that description. And we call them forced American heroes on the application. And we think it's also a way for people to encourage people to research their genealogy, because that's part of what has to happen. You submit an application, and again, it looks very similar to the DAR application, listing you and all of the folks you descend from down to that first person you can identify who was enslaved or indentured in the United States, what became the United States. And I've actually, when I got involved, I was the assistant registrar, and Rick Murphy was the first registrar. And I thought it was a fabulous idea when I first heard about it and I applied. But I also was in the mode of, and this is before I became a trustee of BCG, I tried to involve myself in things that would help me to broaden my horizons and learn new stuff. And I've learned a lot of things just by reviewing applications. I don't know if you know Margot Williams, but she's the current assistant registrar. And I first heard about gradual emancipation legislation in the North reading an application, because you have to prove that you descend from a person who was enslaved, and this particular applicant was his people were free before the Civil War, but it was because he was descended from an enslaved woman, and her child became free under the New Jersey Gradual Emancipation legislation. And that is still not something that gets written about a lot. I think there's one article in the NGSQ about it, and I know that Judy Russell has written about it a couple of times in her blog, but it's not something that I have been aware of before seeing this application. And you do get a better sense of what the various laws were in these jurisdictions that had slavery. So that was the first reason that I, when I was asked to become the assistant registrar, that I said yes, just because it's interesting and gets me out of my, you know, focus on South Carolina and the rest of the South. And it's a way to encourage people to research their genealogy, because I really believe that if younger folk could just learn this stuff, it would give them just a source of pride and inspiration that they, where else do you get that? I, for example, for years thought I was the first lawyer in my family. I did not know that my great grandfather had a first cousin. He was licensed to practice law in South Carolina in 1890. Wow. But we had kind of lost touch with that branch of the family. And I have another cousin, my great-grandfather's sisters had a grandson who went to Howard Law School and was a student and helped work, you know, on the brief of Brown versus Board of Education. And I didn't even know that till he died. I knew he was a lawyer, but I didn't know that till he died, and it was in his obituary. So think about, you know, just sometimes knowing that something has been done is the last nudge you need to get things done. I have this other theory, but it would take up your whole show. And my theory has to do, because we have a lot of lawyers in our family, and my Garrett's second great grandmother was purchased as an 8-year-old by a lawyer, and by someone whose father had been a lawyer, and who was the brother-in-law of John Belton O'Neill, who became the chief judge of the South Carolina Supreme Court. And whatever her experience, he held her in bondage till she was in her late 20s, and he went bankrupt trying to be a planter and died not long after that. But I think because her experience, something about that experience made her name her youngest son, give her youngest son this guy's middle name, which was Stobo, which was this guy's mother's maiden name. I think it's a Scottish surname. And I just think that somewhere in our genes, this idea was planted that the law was something we should do. That's one theory I have anyway, but I'm digressing again.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I love it. It's all about the stories, but I like that you bring that up about the connections with the law, but also with younger folks and the inspiration and understanding and knowing your ancestry, and knowing your ancestors' place in history and being part of this, part of the sons and daughters of the United States Middle Passage, being part of that group and wearing that with honor. I mean, I will admit I have not applied yet. I have printed out the application. I do have it. Wonderful. I do have it. Wonderful. It has its own folder and everything, but I will be filling out my application for sure. But I'm so excited that you're part of that process. But let's get to South Carolina, because I have both a printed copy, which I have next to me, and a Kindle copy of your book. So let's talk about your book you published in 2016, A Guide to Researching African-American Ancestors in, correct me if I'm wrong, Lawrence County?
It's Lawrence, as in Henry Lawrence, who was a major slave trader and then was one of the presidents of the Continental Congress.
Okay. Okay.
And the father of John Lawrence of Hamilton fame.
Oh, I don't know if you've seen Hamilton yet. Okay, a guide to researching African American ancestors in Lawrence County, South Carolina. Maybe I probably messed that up. And selected finding aids, but we'll have a link to the book. So, what made you decide to write this book? You've talked about your career in tax, talked about your kind of what you were doing in your Garrett family and how you found all this information about them. But why write a book about this particular county?
First, let me say that I think I'm a pretty good genealogist, but not great at marketing. Because had I was, I would have probably maybe had a different title. The book got a great review in that long-running genealogy column in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the title of it is like, You Guide as a Model for Others. And they say, you know, people can use this in other South Carolina counties and other states. And so when I've been in venues where I've sold the book, I try to point that out to folks because people are kind of put off by the title. But I'll tell you that I decided to write it for the same reason that I decided to kind of focus on African-American genealogy, because there are many books that do a good job of narrating how the author did their work on their family, or a good job on, there are lots of books about records, where to find them. But I really had not seen anything that did what I really tried to do in every chapter, just sharing my knowledge. And one example is that no one had told me that you really can't trust census records. And yes, expect different spellings of names, because up until the early 1900s, people used phonetic spellings. And because even today, people on different Facebook posts, they recite what was in the census as if it's the gospel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and just information like enslaved people couldn't marry. So how do you attach people? And I talk about grave markers and the importance of Black churches and just the what's the information on the grave markers. And if you were fortunate enough to own land before a state like South Carolina that didn't do away with dower rights until forever, you might have had someone sign as a wife so that was evidence before, because South Carolina didn't require statewide registration of marriages until 1911. So before that, there was no documents necessarily. Forget about beyond 1870, going beyond that. So I really did, even though it is focused on my home county, and I did, for example, I went through there was a South Carolina 1869 state census. It's online now, but it wasn't online in 2016. And I went through that thing and took out all and just indexed the Black people. And people still find that useful, actually, to just be able to look in the index and see that that person at least was someone with that name was listed in Lawrence County, enumerated in 1869. And I did the same thing with, I talk about tax mm-hmm. records and really try to just include more about methodology and what you do with these records mm-hmm. than focusing on the records themselves.
You mentioned with that column in Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
The genealogy column. Yeah.
And that was one of my questions that, you know, this could be a guide, I guess, a guide for folks in other states, right? If you're doing research, for example, Virginia is where my folks were. So if you're doing research in Culpeper or Madison, you know, or if you're doing research in Alabama, this could definitely be a guide to help people, you know, sort of an outline. It's probably not the word I'm looking for.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's what I meant it to be, to mm-hmm. give people a sense, because, you know, the records will be different in every state, obviously, but I would say that, you know, they weren't that different. Different states came along more slowly to enacting laws that limited the rights of free people of color, of enslaved people.
Right, right.
But there are only so many ways you can handle those things, right? And like, we didn't have registers of free colored people in South Carolina, but we had a head tax. But the only thing that survives, as far as I know, are the records for Charleston. But in Virginia, you have those great registers.
Yeah, the cohabitation. Yeah, cohabitation registers. Yeah, which are very valuable. So with your book, I mean, I think it's great that you did that. And I like that your approach to methodologies is one of the things when we first met, you kind of said to me, this is sort of my focus, right? I'm writing articles, I'm about methodology. Like, and I like that because I feel like within the profession, especially with African-American genealogists, there's room for all of us and we all do things differently, right? I mean, we all contribute. One of the questions I often get, and I always ask genealogists this, most of them, is, you know, what advice would you give someone that's interested in becoming a professional genealogist, right? And they listen to us in this podcast, or they see me on TV, or they listen to you or read your book, you know, and they say, that's fun, I want to do that. Like, what would you tell them?
I really try to emphasize the importance of getting an education. And I always start with myself because I'm kind of overeducated. That did not help stop me from making all of the mistakes that people make who don't understand that there are tried and proven ways to approach genealogical problem solving. And you would save yourself a lot of trouble by, and there were so many, that's the other thing. When in the 70s, there were not these, the classes and all of these institutes that we now have. So many opportunities to get educated about this. So that's the first thing that I would say, that it really is important too. And you don't have to spend a lot of money. The other thing that there wasn't was ProGen, which is something that I did before I applied. And I think it's still only $100 just for access to their base camp. But basically they go through the book Professional Genealogy. You get feedback from the other participants and you learn something. So that's the basic advice I would give. The other thing is that, and I think this is true in any profession, the importance of networking. It was certainly true when I practiced law. People really came to me out of the blue. I got referrals from people who had worked with me, especially people on the Hill, people who knew that I knew what I was doing, would tell other people. And that's how genealogy is. It's that's how the world operates. Networking and understanding. Because the other thing is that none of us, it's kind of like when I was practicing tax law, I ended up really kind of specializing in international tax. And I did that mainly because people didn't want to do it. And it was still something people outside companies would pay for because it was hard. And the same thing is true though in genealogy. There's no one person who just knows every record set, and you need to be able to reach out to to colleagues. You need to have a network of people you can just ask questions to. I've had someone pull a record for me and just refuse payment. That could be helpful too to people. Just having those relationships that you've established.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Networking is one of the things I learned just being, not when practicing law, because I didn't do that as my career in tech and sales, but networking is definitely important. And I know for genealogists, we kind of sit at a computer by ourselves looking for dead people, not really talking to anybody. So hearing the word networking may seem frightening, right? Or overwhelming, but it is true. All of the things that I have done, even being on TV, as well as the 1619 Project, have all been a part of my network. And that is really important. I really wanted to thank you so much for this conversation. It's been great. I've learned a lot. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, let me say that I appreciate your inviting me to join you to talk about my favorite subject.
Conversations with Kenyatta is produced by Kenyatta D. Berry and Caitlin Owl, and features Kenyatta D. Berry. The music for this episode was Good Vibe by Ketza. Follow Kenyatta on Instagram under the handle kenyatta.berry, on Facebook at facebook.com/kenyattadb, and on Twitter at kenyattadb. You can also find more information on her book and upcoming events on her website at kenyattaberry.com.